Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Les with CIA, and we're back after many, many months of doing nothing. So let's get started. With me in the room today is Benjamin Elliott, who you might remember from being on our show quite a bit. How you doing today, Benjamin?
That's good to be here, Les.
Yeah,
it's good to be back this time.
Today's topic is going to be, starting out, we'll be talking about the new Prisoner that came on. I know lots of people talk about it, but our topic's going to be like, what makes it a successful remake or reimagining or whatever they want to call it, and maybe compare a little bit of the original Prisoner with the new Prisoner, and then we'll segue into a broader topic of what makes a remake good and what makes a remake bad. And that's just our humble opinions here. So, first things first, I think, let's see, Benjamin, you were talking about a way to watch The Prisoner before we started the show, so if you want to kind of tell people that,
yes,
that might help them out enjoy it a little bit more.
Yes, if you know, AMC premiered the new version of The Prisoner. They ran it over three nights in the U.S., the 15th, the 16th, and 17th, and they ran it as 3 2-hour blocks with commercial breaks, but essentially three movies. And the movies were a bit disjointed because, you know, they filmed it as six episodes. Well, if you have on-demand, either cable on-demand or DirecTV's on-demand service, most of the on-demands actually have The Prisoner from AMC right now. I checked, not Hulu. Hulu just has the old Prisoner, and I think that's coming down soon. But if you have on-demand service, you can just go through, find The Prisoner 2009, and they have them as six episodes. So instead of trying to sit through a two-hour block and having commercials jump in at odd moments, you can watch them, opening credits, closing credits, and it actually feels like an episode of the 60s Prisoner, which is less confusing this way. It makes more sense as six episodes because I was watching this thing, and I was watching it at a glacial pace, piece by piece, in my recordings. I was having trouble. A few days ago, I found it on demand. I watched episodes 5 and 6, finally finished it, and it flowed much better for me. It was much easier watching it that way.
They tried to make it as gentle as possible. It's a, The Prisoner, maybe we should do a little background real quick. The Prisoner was a show that came on in 67 and 68, and it stars Patrick McGoohan. Now, Patrick McGoohan is a very good British actor who, he's famous for shows like, he did one called Danger Man, which I think here with Secret Agent, they love to do that. When they have a British show, they'll bring it to America and show it like in syndication, but they'll change the name because they think we're too stupid to figure out what Danger Man means. And Secret Agent's a little bit more blatant because American television's more, to me, spoon-fed than, say, British television where you actually get to think and use your mind. But that's just me. But basically, the crux of The Prisoner is a secret agent who goes in and in the opening credits of every show, he quits and then goes home and gets gassed. And when he wakes up, he's in this place called The Village. And it's just in a seaside village resort. It's like a little town. And he's not given a name. He's given a number. And the number's number 6. And there's all kinds of different numbers in the village. And the people that run the village, who you don't really know who they are trying to get information out of number 6 about why he's retiring or quitting or whatever, not becoming a secret agent. And they use different kinds of mind control devices and psychological warfare against him. And it can be a confusing show, although I've read many articles about it lately. And in the past when it was on, like PBS showed it when I was a kid, and I got hooked on it. It's a very good show, and a lot of people consider it one of the best television shows ever made just because of its production value and that Patrick McGoohan was such a stickler for everything that, he controlled the whole thing and kept the storyline going. But it was on for, they did like 17 episodes of it, I believe. And it had a lot of 1960s themes of counterculture and, the effect of programming people's minds and stuff like that. And they have the protagonist is a character called Number 2. and number two runs the village. The thing is, on the original show, number two was different in just about every episode. I think there was only one actor that played him twice, and that was at the very beginning and the very end. And the end's even ambiguous. You don't really know how it happens. Now, it's a classic series that a lot of people love, and then AMC comes along and remakes it, or I guess you would call it a reimagining. And basically, it's pretty weird. I mean, it's kind of cool weird, but they got Jim Caviezel, who many people have seen in movies like my favorite one with him in his Frequency, but he also played Jesus in The Passion of the Christ, and you know, he's just been in a bunch of stuff. Like, very, I guess, understated actor. He's not, like, you know, over hammy or cheesy like some people are. He plays a very reserved number six. So I know McGowan would get excitable sometimes playing his character as he's trying to escape from the village. And he can't leave. And you don't know where the village is. And every time he goes, there's this big, gigantic white ball thing called Rover that shows up and pushes him back in. And then it's, you have to watch the classic series. Now, the new series has the feel of it. And some inspired casting with, you know, I think Caviezel's really good. And, of course, having Gandalf in there as number two is kind of the best thing about it. Benjamin, what do you think about it? Have you seen the original Prisoner, correct?
Yes. I discovered, I'd heard about it. I tried to watch a little bit. I pretty much saw it about the time it came out on DVD. So I saw this thing around 2001. And that's when I got to see it. And it was, I really liked the show. But my least favorite episode was the last one, because I did find that rather convoluted, I must admit. I think the last one is a rather controversial episode, and it's possible to love the show and be a bit confused and unsatisfied with the ending. So,
Yeah,
and I think you're going to have people who like the ending and dislike the ending. I wasn't really happy with the ending, but I liked how the lead up enough, and I admire their attempt at telling the story their own way enough that I still like the show. So,
yeah, the thing about The Prisoner, it was originally written as like a 6 or 12 episode like mini series, and then McGowan left to go film a movie. And while they were filming the movie, the guys that produced it decided they want to add a bunch of episodes and make one season. So he had already started and finished it. So he had to write a bunch of episodes to fill out in the middle, which I think, as he came up with newer ideas, kind of messed up the finale because all this other stuff had happened that wasn't previously written in. But it's very out there. I mean, you almost have to be on LSD or something to really follow the final episode of it. But it's beautifully shot. McGowan, I don't even think, speaks but one line in the finale. But it's very convoluted, and you really need to watch it from the beginning to the end. Now, the convoluted part is something they really moved over into the new one because, you know, the first couple of episodes of it, I'm sitting there going, you know, I know The Prisoner, but this is kind of confusing a little bit.
Go ahead. I think with the original Prisoner, they seem to build the show around... The show was very much around McGowan, which I suppose made sense. Because basically, McGowan was in charge of everything. It was around number six. And you had all these twos, and they were just ordinary. They were almost bureaucrats, and the twos just coming back and forth. But six was the real lead. And the new Prisoner, two was at least as important as six. And two seemed to be a much more important character this time around than the original. So.
Right. Two was just kind of thrown in there to confuse the audience a little bit during the original show. Now, the new series states that there is no one, but the other Prisoner talked about one, but they never showed him. And actually, I don't want to give away the plot twist ending if anybody wants to know, but it has to do with one on the original series. Now, the new series didn't really end with that. And the new series really went away with what the village was, I think, didn't it?
It was a little bit
out there, but I mean, it was, you know, I like when they take a chance on a show and not leave it like you know, blah, 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 A to B. And I think a lot of American audiences aren't going to like it as much. But I think it's doing pretty well in Britain. You know, that's one of their flagship shows from the 60s. And it's pretty well known. I mean, it's like right up there with, you know, our favorite show. But let's talk production value. What do you think about the way they shot it, the new one?
I think the new one was very beautiful filming. I got to see it on AMC HD, at least at first, and then on the on-demand lower quality later. And the picture, it's very beautiful. It's, you know, like the original Prisoner was very beautiful for the 1960s, and this one took full advantage of today. You had excellent pictures of South Africa. You could feel like you were there. And many shows,
right,
I think, have shied back from that a bit. But this show, they really went the extra mile on the picture. And you felt like you were there, even if you weren't sure where there was.
Right.
So.
I would say that the ending is a little surprising because at first I didn't notice. Now, the thing about this Prisoner, it's a major departure from the other one, is there's a lot of secondary characters that you actually get into, whereas the other one, you had different people every week showing up to kind of interact with number six. This one had a stable of characters that were interacting with him all the time and even causing some romances to fly around and little subplots between all of them. I mean, it was at first it's confusing, but as the plot threads start to weave together and, you know, solidified toward the end, it started to get pretty exciting and interesting.
I think there's a conscious reason for that.
Like, yeah.
I think it's deliberate, because if you made it like the original, if you made it so there's one person we're following the whole way, then anyone who knows the original show, the closer it is to the original show, the more we are comparing him to Patrick McGoohan. And
right.
I don't think Jim Caviezel was in charge of the production. I don't think he had the roles that McGoohan had, and therefore it wouldn't be fair to judge him on the same scale. So,
right. Well, I would have to say I was impressed with his performance. I think he did a very good job with what he had, especially filling in the shoes of somebody like McGoohan. But, yeah, you're right. They had to change the show so much that it wasn't an ape of the original Prisoner. Well, first of all, writing for television has changed a lot since the 60s. Because, you know, stuff's a lot more realistic nowadays. And when you're doing a show, I mean, it's kind of like when they, when you do a show about mind control also, it's like psychological dramas and things like that. And then you get into the characters that are around him, like the guy and his wife who lose their kid, and then the nurse in the hospital that's actually in love with him, and then the girl that he meets. That what was fascinating about this show is they kept showing flashbacks to his real life while he's doing all the stuff in the village. Sometimes it got confusing, but I thought it was very interesting to see that number six is actually someone outside, because they never really showed that in the original show except for the opening credits when they show him as his alter ego. And there's a lot of fan conjecture, just to change the subject for a second, on the original series that he's actually playing his Danger Man character. And that it's kind of like a pseudo-sequel to the Danger Man show, which is very popular. And they've never actually said whether or not he was playing his Drake character from that. But I would have to say that because of the performances of Ian McKellen, who was fantastic as it, and as a matter of fact, once they named Ian McKellen, I really couldn't think of another actor that could do number two. And he was kind of like a link to the original series, because he's very similar to the guy who played him, Liam McKern, in the first and last episode. And it gave like a, you know, for Prisoner fans, like a little link to the past. And then you got a new number six, who's a little bit different the way he's acting and stuff like that. I'm trying to let Diane on the show. Can you hear us, Diane?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You're pretty clear, too. How's it going?
Oh, it's going okay.
Good. Long-time listeners of the show. Go ahead.
I may mute every now and then because I still have a bit of a cough.
Dan, did you watch The Prisoner?
Yes, I did.
What did you think about it?
I have to say, I actually have the first two sets of DVDs from the original, and I tried watching it, and barely got through the first episode, didn't finish the second one. It was just, I have a problem with some older stuff just because it moves so much slower, and I don't know if, you know, I've gotten spoiled with our short attention span theater we have now.
Right.
And it wasn't good. I didn't enjoy it at all, so I stopped watching it. I didn't make it through all of the new one, though, and while it was very pretty, it still didn't make much sense.
Right.
But there was, you know, while you were talking about, you know, his flashbacks, his real life, one of the things that I kind of think was that they weren't flashbacks. They were happening at the same time.
So it's almost like the character was in a dual place, and that's even more confusing for him because he's having all these memories from his outside life and all these memories from his inside life that are kind of
through the whole thing, I don't know if you said anything about spoiler warnings. Are we going to actually talk about everything that happened, or do I have to?
No, you can go ahead and discuss the show. It's been out for a while now, so I don't think we got too many spoilers going on.
Okay, well, one of the things, you're trying to figure out what's going on, and like I said, they seem like flashbacks that, you know, he resigned, and then that girl followed him, and, you know, they have that whole experience on that, but it's happening simultaneously with what's happening in the village. And then the way it ended with, you know, you finding out that the whole world basically was a construct of Helen, who was Number Two's wife. And then basically they left, and it destroyed the world, and 313 became the new dreamer who was dreaming the world, and he was going to, you know, start all over again. But it's the way that kind of came through that it seemed like at the point where Number Two in the real world, you know, shows Michael, who's Number Six.
Right.
You know, it explains what happened. It's like at that point, that's when the village ended. And it something that Two had said too when they were talking about what they were doing is that they were really helping people. And 147, who was the taxi driver, was the limo driver in the real world.
Right.
And he was saying that how much that the guy had helped him, and, you know, he was putting his life back together, and he was looking forward to getting his daughter back. And so it seems to me that maybe it was happening at the same time, that what they did to help people is maybe that they had the destructive tendencies, and making this dream world, they pulled that part of them out and gave them a place of their own to play, while then the real person could get their act together and you know, calm down their life, and they could rebuild it.
Right.
So that was just the theory I had.
Well, I would have to say that it was an interesting departure from the original series to actually give you Number Six's name. And then I've noticed that I don't know if you call them flashbacks. I guess it would be like side flashes of what's going on. Those got more frequent as the episodes went further on. And it basically made it, to me, a little bit more interesting to find out these little snippets that are going along. And then, you know, he's got little romances going on. And then the other characters, you kind of saw what they were like. And you never really knew whether Number Two was really totally evil or just messing with people or just even there to begin with. The one episode that was confusing to people I was watching it was the one where Two becomes Un-Two, where he's not really Two and they're chasing him around because he's not real. And he's like, the scene with him and the guy in the store, the smoking cigarettes, was just fantastically written, I thought.
Uh-huh.
It was creepy, but it was good at the same time, and only Ian McKellen could probably do it that way. But I think Jim Caviezel's version of Number Six,
where he was Un-Two, but then Six became Two Sixes.
Yeah, I know. You it's know, like split personality.
Yeah.
And the weird thing was, at first you're thinking Six could only see it, but then other people started seeing the other Six popping up because they're all like, "You were in my house last night. Get away from me." And he's like, "I wasn't in your house."
Yeah.
And it was just pretty fascinating, I think. All right, everybody joining us in the room, I believe, is Dave. What's going on, Dave? Hey, Dave muted himself. Never mind.
Well, I think you still have him on mute as well.
Okay.
I see the red circle on the line.
Yeah, I unmuted him, but he muted back. Let me try again.
Ooh.
Dave, can you hear us?
I was. No, you're a bit rusty there, lad. Now, hi, guys. Sorry I'm a bit late, but I did send you a message on Twitter. I hope you got that.
Yeah, I just saw it a few minutes ago.
Okay.
So, how are things going?
Yeah, fine. Don't let me interrupt the flow of the show. I'm just here to give you a bit of support as you get back in the chair as it is.
I appreciate that very much. You don't know how much. Did you get to see The Prisoner?
I haven't seen a lot of it. I saw the 10-minute trailer, seen a few snippets, and I talked with Lewis and James about it on the latest Hitchhiker's Guide to British Sci-Fi. Because although it isn't a British sci-fi, as probably somebody's mentioned already in the show, it's based on the original Patrick McGoohan. Well, seems pretty loosely based on it, but that was the origin of the thing. So because it was that, and it has a couple of British actors in it, and particularly I think it's the Doctor, is it 333 or 313, Ruth, I'm forgetting the second name, but a brilliant actress. She played Jane in Jane Eyre here in the BBC only recently. And I'm trying to figure.
Yeah, I thought she was one of the best parts of the entire miniseries, actually. She captures tortured person very well.
I think it was filmed with ITV, so it's at least partially a British show. It's, you know, the co-production there, like. So it gets at least partial credit.
Well, you know, I guess the hardest thing, and this gets into like the second half of our topic here, is what makes a reimagining work or a remake work, and what doesn't is capturing enough of the original so that fans can kind of follow along, and then not making it so much like the original that it's just a copycat, then therefore it gets compared all the time to it. Because, you know, like, it's very hard actually to compare Jim Caviezel to Patrick McGoohan because they're totally different style of acting. And number two, you can kind of compare because that's just one of those ambiguous characters. You really, literally, in the original series, could stick any actor in there and they can play the part. I thought visually and the tonality of the thing was good, of the remake. I think it was different from the original Prisoner, and it's more like in name only, except things like The Village and Number Two and the numbers for names were the same. But really, a lot of it was different. And I kind of like that because, you know, what's the point of doing a remake that's exactly like, I mean, here's a good example of what I think is a bad remake was the shot-for-shot remake of Psycho that Gus Van Sant did. I mean, how do you remake Alfred Hitchcock? Well, let's do it exactly the same way Hitchcock did and call it mine. I mean, that doesn't work. I didn't think it worked, but they didn't do that with The Prisoner is what I'm trying to say. And I really like that. And there's a bunch of other shows and movies that have succeeded and haven't. And I guess I'm going to open the floor to people and get people's impressions of what they thought was a good remake in their opinion. Like, we'll start with Benjamin here. Benjamin, out of remakes that you've seen, what's your favorite? Do you have one?
Well, the thing is that I'm trying to think. Two remakes that I really liked were really just continuations, and one of them would be Doctor Who, and the other one would be All Creatures Great and Small, which, if you recall, that show ended in 1980. They had two union films, came back in 1987 with the original cast except for one person being dead and one recast. And essentially, it was the continuation of the same show, and I thought it was very effective. Now, when you actually go to remakes of productions, that's always trickier. In many ways, the Tin Man redo of The Wizard of Oz. There was a lot of good in that miniseries, and I was surprised that they didn't go ahead with their plans to try to make a TV show out of it. So that's an odd one, but there you go. And while I would say it's flawed, the Battlestar Galactica of 2003 to this year, that was a very original remake compared to the show it came from.
Ah, but that one's considered a reimagining, which begs the point of what's the difference between a remake and a reimagining?
The word you use.
Yeah,
it's
I guess.
Really
well, I mean, I guess the reimagining is taking... I guess a reimagining is taking basic elements of something and going off on your own tangent with it as opposed to following along the guidelines of the original. Because, Battlestar Galactica is definitely different than the original. But you got shows like, the new V is a good example. Its tonality is the same as the original. The characters are different. The plot line is somewhat basically the same. I think the difference being is production value. Now, I think the new V is pretty good. It doesn't hold a place in my heart like the original Mark Singer, cheesy, ripping skin off Visitor show, but, you can't have everything. But you're right, like the new Doctor Who is more like, the show took a hiatus for almost 20 years and came back is basically how that one is, because they were smart and they continued on from where it left off somewhat, as opposed to starting over again with all new stuff. That would have been really horrible, I think.
I think you could do a good restart from the beginning, but it would have been harder to do. It would have taken more work to start it from the beginning and make it be good than to bring it back.
I think the fan base on that show, the fan base on Doctor Who would have been the hardest part to make happy with a complete reboot. And that's where a good 90% of
your... I'm glad you didn't this time.
Yeah. Dave, you got any opinions on some of your favorite remakes?
And it's mostly not good. One of the worst remakes I didn't really like. Although I liked Samantha Mumba in it, was The Time Machine. I love the original Time Machine, and it almost has become, films are made of a certain age. Have that character about them, and I loved the friendship of the two main characters, the Scottish chap and so on, and I'm assuming we all know the story, whereas the second Time Machine I didn't particularly like. Same with the Planet of the Apes. Charlton Heston might not be everybody's cup of tea, but Planet of the Apes was probably one of his best films, although I loved him in Omega Man and one or two others, but I've seen the remake of the Planet of the Apes again since on the DVD, and I enjoyed it a little bit more after I'd had time to get accustomed to it. But I was not that pleased with it because, of course, they had all the talking and so on. If we're talking about TV, there was the Avengers, and then they had the New Avengers. Which some people thought it was a bit more styly. Other people didn't think it was as quirky, though, and lost a little bit of its... they weren't so keen on the actors, perhaps, in the second version. And
They did the same thing with The Man from U.N.C.L.E., too, didn't they? They had the original Man from U.N.C.L.E., then they brought it back with, younger people, but you still had the two main characters pop in from time to time. I remember seeing that.
Right.
They only had a movie. They didn't actually do a series of Man from U.N.C.L.E., at least not under that name. They had a movie in 83, and they had a spinoff while the original was running. But they had The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. while the original was running, which isn't exactly, that's like having Torchwood.
And, of course... one of the greatest successes was, in actual fact, a switch from film to TV. In as fact, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer came out as a film first, with a different actress in the lead role, and then somebody took the courage to think that there was still, a really good story to be told there. And of course, we had 7 seasons then of Sarah Michelle Gellar as Buffy, and it was a very unpromising start. When you think back to that film, so that's another one. But that involves the switch between TV and film.
Right, and you know, the most successful movie to TV show series of all time is MASH, which MASH was actually a very good movie, and then the TV show was a classic. So there are instances where that worked. And that's definitely one of them. And there are instances like when I was a kid, I remember they made a TV series based on the Ferris Bueller's Day Off movie. And that show was just horrible, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, especially since it was already had been done with
Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
Yeah, they had Parker Lewis out the same story.
One of the, it's not strictly a remake, because although in one way it is, because I'm thinking of Smallville, because of course there's been lots of different Superman TV series, and I've heard, although I've been ill a couple of weeks back, and I watched about 30 episodes of series 6 and 7, which I had thought before I watched them it was going off a little bit, but I really enjoyed them. But I have heard it said that as it's getting towards season 8 and so on, it's turning into Lois and Clark, which of course was the Dean Cain reimagining of the Superman story in the 80s. In fact, I think I've just watched an episode, I think in series 7, where Dean Cain comes on and does exactly what a lot of... Tom Baker said this, hasn't he, with Doctor Who. He'd love to come back to Doctor Who, but as a villain. I mean, I know he's come back
right
on the audio disc, but if he wanted to, if he was coming in to actually into the new Doctor Who, he'd like to come back as a villain. And Dean Cain, without being spoilish about it, he made a guest appearance on Smallville as... a villain. And one of the great things about Smallville that I have enjoyed is so many of the actors in it have actually been in the original Superman, because of course the chap who played Virgil Swan, or whatever it's called, was the original Christopher Reeve Superman.
Right.
Kidder, Margot Kidder, played his secretary, who was of course the Lois Lane. We've had I've just seen one where the lady who plays Clark's mother from Krypton is none other than the girl who played Supergirl in the Supergirl movie, and there's been one or two others like that.
The original TV Lois Lane has been on there as well.
Yeah,
and
of course Martha, the girl who plays Superman's Clark's mother, she played young Lois Lane, didn't she, as well?
No, she played
Lana Lang in Superman 3.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, I like that, the nod to those little things. I think just as a lot of us fans like in New Doctor Who, that they make nods to the early series. Like I was rewatching Utopia recently, and they're right at the end of the galaxy, and the Doctor's searching for the word to describe the human race, and he goes, indomitable, yes, that's the word, indomitable, which of course is the word that the fourth Doctor used, is it in Ark in Space or somewhere. So I love those little nods to earlier series, which is not quite the question
right. You
asked me, but never mind.
I think we lucked out with Doctor Who and the fact that the production team that took over for the new series were all fans, as opposed to just sticking some good producer in there that thinks he knows what he's doing. Because all the nods to the classic series, they're giving us just enough of them, not too many, you know, where it makes it cheesy, but there's just enough nods to things. And I love classic companions coming back.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess you call Doctor Who a continuation. I guess it's not really a reimagining, and it's definitely not a remake. It's just a reboot, I guess you could say.
Yeah, well, the point is, because they still have, it's the same company doing it, in effect, they haven't got any copyright to worry about in terms of, you know, they can bring back the Master in the new series because, you know, they didn't have to say, we don't own the rights to the Master, we can't have him. They renegotiated the rights with the Daleks so they could have the Daleks back in and all the other things. So that continuity is there.
I would have to say, like, one that comes to mind right now that's a, I guess it's a remake, reboot, and continuation at the same time. Well, maybe not continuation, but it was when Timothy Dalton was coming out as James Bond. There's one James Bond story that's actually not owned by the production company. It's Thunderball. It's owned by the actual writer of the original movie. And he has the remake rights for Thunderball, but you can't, you know, MGM or United Artists owns all the James Bond movie contrivances, like, you know, the James Bond theme and the way the movie's set up and the opening credits and all that. Well, they remade Thunderball in the 80s as Never Say Never Again and brought Sean Connery back to compete with Timothy Dalton. And it's kind of funny because he's James Bond, but you don't have any of the James Bond stuff. Q's not in it. Instead, they put Rowan Atkinson, which I thought was good. And the James Bond theme isn't in it. And it's a funny little aberration in moviness, I guess. You have a James Bond film without all the James Bond contrivances because another company owned it all. And that's what you're talking about there. It's like the BBC didn't have to do that because they own it all, so they can make an official one. And
yeah. I mean, and again, you'll be sorry I came because, I mean, one of the things I'd like to add to that is as well, if you can extend the question and stretch it even more, one of the shows that I'd like to see remade, because one of the ones, and I can hear Ken cheering in the background as I speak, The Tripods. I mean, because it was a three-part story that only got two parts made. That is absolutely crying out for, you know, the visual effects they could do with, you know, CGI and what have you now. They could actually really do that justice, and I would like, that's a remake I would like to see done.
I completely agree with you on that one. Tripods is like one of those just jewel in the crowns that they had from the 80s that they should have gone more with. And if I'm not mistaken, that's another victim of Michael Grade, wasn't it?
I think you may be right there, yeah. Well, it's budget as well, I think. And of course, they have tried a few times to get Blake 7 back. Now, that's come back in audio form. There have been some audio things done, and the person who played Avon has tried to get it brought back. And the other one, of course, you could argue that Red Dwarf has actually come back in a sense when they made the special.
Yeah, and I think like Red Dwarf coming back owes a lot to Doctor Who being so popular. Because, you know, now all the companies are like, well, yeah, let's take all our sci-fi stuff and see what we got, and we can put it back out again. All right,
yeah.
Here's a reboot that I actually think was very successful, is the new Star Trek. I didn't think it was going to be, and if I can edit this podcast later, I'm going to edit in a section from one of my old shows on Geek Week from about 4 years ago when they announced it, and I'm going to eat crow because I'm changing my opinion. So, but I would have to say the new Star Trek, the production team behind that.
You mean this year's movie or Next Generation 87?
Well, I guess I'm talking about this year's movie.
Yeah.
I think it's one movie that could have been really, really, really done badly that they did right. And they did it in a way that didn't take away from the original, and the performances of the actors didn't crap on the performances of the original actors, and made them their own, but still the same. I mean, it was just a joy to watch it visually, and the story was there, the acting was there. I mean, it was pretty good, I thought. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I was bought it by my daughter on Blu-ray, and I watched it only a couple of nights ago, and I think it's 95% there. I only had two quibbles with it, well, three quibbles, but they're actually diminishing now in strength. One was, I didn't like the fact that they almost had Spock and Kirk at the same age. I always thought of Spock being about 60 when Kirk was about 30, if you know what I mean, because the longer-lived species. Secondly, I didn't really like his open romance with Uhura. And thirdly,
right,
I wasn't really keen on Simon Pegg's portrayal, but, I mean, that might be just because we've got preconceived ideas of Simon Pegg here in the UK. But there was about 5% out of 100%. It was 95% there, I thought.
Well, you know, the thing about Simon Pegg that I noticed, I think what made it hard to watch was the fact that his accent is actually a lot more accurate than James Doohan's was. Not knocking Doohan, but doing was an American that specialized in accents, and he was doing an Americanized version of a Scottish accent, just to kind of throw that brogue in there. But, you know, he was actually doing a dialect in this one, and it made him more Scottish, if you know what I mean. And it was almost like he was over the top sometimes. But I think they really couldn't have found a better actor to play Scotty, and they didn't really give him a lot to do in this particular movie. I think the next movie, once they're out of the constraints of having to introduce everyone, it'll be a little bit better.
Yeah, and there was one other thing, and then I'll let Diane. Oh, Diane's dropped off, and she's sorry. The young chap, not the Sulu, the young Chekhov. He was very nearly on the brink of becoming a Yaya Binks, or what they call from Star Wars.
Yeah,
you know, they were just, to me, slightly sending up that, you know, he's. He couldn't pronounce his W's or his R's or whatever, and they were just really taking the mickey out of him a little bit too much, I thought. So
there,
he could have been the Jar Jar
Binks
of the show.
The accent was too authentic because, you know, like in the future, Chekhov was a little less thick Russian. This guy was like thick Russian accent, which made it a little more cartoony, I think. But I think overall the performance is really good. The Sulu character was very understated and well done, and I was very impressed with Chris Pine, who played Kirk, because he nailed Kirk.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't nail Shatner. And that's the thing that was cool about it. You could see little snippets of the way William Shatner talks every once in a while, but he nailed the character the way he's supposed to be. And Quinto,
the Doctor was good, wasn't he?
Very good. Now, McCoy was the best one. I mean, it was like he was channeling the Forest Kelly at points, which was really good about it. And but to me, my favorite character in the movie was Bruce Greenwood as Captain Pike. I mean, he really brought some authority to the role, I thought. Not to diminish this into a discussion of the new Star Trek, but that's a good example of a reimagining that works, I think.
Yeah, and I think I've said this before somewhere, that when they're actually, just after he was just about to be court-martialed, and then the warning came that Vulcan was under attack, there was some alert, they didn't know it was an attack at that point, and they're all rushing to their designated ships, and the officer in charge of allocating them to the ships was actually a chap who played the Doctor in Stargate Universe, and I believe he was going to get the role of Bones at one point. He was going to get a major role, but they seemed to just give him that one as a reward.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from what I understand, Carl Urban, who played McCoy, had been watching the classic series with his son and found out they did the movie, and he was a big, huge fan of it. There are some scenes that are pretty interesting nods to the original series. Like, whenever you see Scotty in the transporter room, the guy sitting next to him is actually James Doohan's son, playing just a little cameo. They invited him on to do that, and then, like, the actors actually got together with the people that played them in the original series, except for Pine, who didn't get a lot to talk about with Shatner. And I'll tell you this, if you want to see something funny, go to YouTube. There's a video of a guy showing William Shatner the trailer for Star Trek, and his jaw drops like halfway through it. And it's one of the funniest things you'll ever see, because I think he thought it was going to suck really bad.
Mm.
But it's very funny to watch. I'll talk about a remake that just kind of stuck in my craw, because it's a remake of what a lot of polls consider to be one of the best sci-fi films ever made, and that's The Day the Earth Stood Still. You take this very beautifully shot classic movie. It's kind of like remaking Casablanca. It's very hard to do properly. And then you stick Keanu Reeves in it, and it's like, what? Although I have to say Jennifer Connelly was good in it. But it's just, why? It's kind of like, why? And it didn't do very well, and it kind of blew in and out and was on DVD before you knew it, and I bet you I'll be able to buy it at Walmart in the $5 bin in probably 6 months.
But it was very nearly good. I mean, I don't think it was bad at all. There were some aspects I didn't particularly like. I mean, I quite like that sphere that came that you couldn't see, the impenetrable sphere. So I like that idea of that as a sort of a ship. And there were some aspects of it I liked. And I think Keanu Reeves is the sort of character that he has this slightly disconnected emotional feel. I mean, some people would say that comes across as wooden. Well, it might do if he has to be in a sort of a, you know, where there's lots of dialogue and emotion and what have you. I mean, for instance, City of Angels, which is one of the films that I like, with Meg Ryan and I can't think of the chap's name, but he couldn't have done that, the depth of emotion for that. But this sort of otherworldliness, I think that's something that, you know, is fitted for, like he was when he played Neo in The Matrix. I thought the film was pretty good. I didn't particularly like the way they did the robot, but I don't think it was a failure. It was a sort of a commendable effort, but
I guess I'd have to say I'm a little bit jaded because it's my dad's favorite movie of all time, and I've seen it so many times that it just bothered me when I was watching it. It was kind of like, I don't know. I mean, the change, it was, I guess, cinematically and the way it was put together, it was very good. But there are certain aspects of it that just, I don't know, something off about it to me. And that's just me, I guess. But I grew up with it. And it's kind of like I had the same opinion when I heard about the reimagining of Star Trek. I was like, oh, that's just one of the worst ideas on Earth. They must have just completely run out of stuff. And I wasn't the only one saying that. And then I've noticed a lot of people that I've heard on shows talk about it are changing their attitudes about it. I mean, right.
Yeah, one thing that does annoy me with some films, like, I think it's like the Batman franchise. They've made like 4 or 5 Batman films, and every one seems to be a reboot. You know what I mean? I mean, can you just stick with what you've got? You know what I mean? So I think you can reboot too many times, one of the great things, like, just going back to the Star Trek movie now, there wasn't a weakness, but if anybody was levelling a weakness at it, they might say, well, it looks like the start of a franchise. Well, duh, it was.
Yeah. It's going to be. And, you know, I love the fact that the biggest thing that I loved about this that seemed to be the biggest problem with, say, some Doctor Who episodes is they didn't hit a reset switch at the end of the movie after all the stuff happened. They're continuing on in this new, you know, alternate reality that they created where stuff's been destroyed that surprised me and stuff like that. And it's a very brave choice to do. They could have gone back and hit a reboot and fixed everything, you know, but they didn't, and I like that. I just hope they don't do it in the future.
Well, of course, they've also got the bonus. They can still have Leonard Nimoy, if he's well enough, they can still have him in. They've got two Spocks, haven't they?
Right.
And you can have other people, because think of it. From the original timeline, people are going to notice Spock's disappearance. And it's possible that, depending on how big a mess Spock made of things when he jumped into the past, other people might jump through after him, curious, and you could have Next Generation or Deep Space Nine or Voyager characters show up on this version of Star Trek if you wanted to. Ultimately, you can even have people from the Enterprise show, if they manage to somehow survive to the present day, you can have old versions of them. Because this didn't really, unless you want to count Enterprise's lamentable final episode, the rest of Enterprise would still have happened in this universe.
Right,
so
it would.
So you can have other people pop up if you want to, if you can make a good reason for them to be there.
Hang on. These are events are after Enterprise. Because Scotty's already talked about Admiral... Admiral Archer's dog. So Admiral Archer's Enterprise period as a starship captain are already over.
Yeah, but that means but the fact is that period has not been erased. So people from that show, if they wanted to, could still turn up.
Well, certainly Archer could. Certainly, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't realize what you meant. Yeah.
I would say that Star Trek's in good hands right now if they can continue doing it without, you know, hey, let's redo Wrath of Khan or let's redo Space Seed with a new actor playing Ricardo Montalban's character. I mean, it's they got so many ways they can go, but things are changed enough that the missions of the original series are going to be a little different, which makes it interesting. I just hope they don't reset it in the future at some point. Although I did hear a little aside when a couple of the writers were talking about if they do a series of trilogy or something like that at the very end of one of the movies that they want Admiral Archer's Beagle to just pop back up out of nowhere. And,
well, I mean, I assume that the way the film ended, they're now off on their ongoing mission, not 5-year mission, but their ongoing mission to explore. Basically,
right.
You know, we haven't met the blue skinned people yet, have we? And one or two others, presumably. We've met the green skinned girl because, of course, he has that Uhura has the green skinned girl as a flatmate. So.
Yeah. And she probably got blown up in that first attack because everybody but the Enterprise got destroyed. But I'd have to say, I mean, it was action all the way, and it never let up the whole time you're watching it. And that's what made it exciting. It was a good summer movie, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about Batman a minute ago, Dave. I guess we can't say anything without a reboot or reimagining when we're talking about the newer versions of Batman. You know, like the classic ones, the first two, I like better than the second two. Second two were more like the original 60s series, and the first two were more like the comic books. But the Christian Bale ones are just very well done, I think. They got the good director, Christopher Nolan, who is famous for doing the movie Memento, which I think is one of the most interesting films I've ever seen, because it's told from the end of the movie to the beginning of the movie. And he just has a good grasp on, you know, getting good actors to play the characters that can push the story along as opposed to just using Batman as an action tool. And, you know, The Dark Knight, I think, was definitely the best Batman movie they ever made.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, we've usually been, you know, shaking in our boots what we're going to do with these franchises. But there's two, The Dark Knight and the Star Trek, that really worked. And the third one of that would be the Daniel Craig Bond. I mean, in a way, that was a relaunch because they'd gone back to a more gritty Bond, haven't they? The second one, Quantum of Solace, I wasn't quite taken with. I mean, they built looks like a building in the middle of the desert that was just built to be blown up. I mean,
now the problem with Casino Royale, which I thought was to me one of the best Bond movies they did, and it was very close to what the original idea for Bond in the books was. The problem with it is Judy Dench in it as M, when you got all these movies beforehand, you know, I guess it's supposed to be his first mission, but that makes me think that it's like Doctor Who, where Bond is actually the code name for whoever is playing Bond. You know what I mean? It's like, that's why, you know, she can still be M, and we've just lost, you know, the last Bond, and we got a new guy who's being trained. Maybe that 007 is his code name. I mean, I know the 007 part is, but the James Bond might be a code name. So you got a different guy every once in a while. Is James Bond just a code name? You know what I mean?
Well, that can make sense, especially if we're supposed to be treating these as a series of fictionalized events. Like, if we're supposed to think that MI5 and MI6 are releasing these fictional stories, like the names that have been changed to protect the guilty. So,
right.
If we're supposed to believe these are propaganda, these fictionalized tales, then it makes perfect sense that they're training up the new guy. However, since their premise has to be the same, the new guy has to be almost very similar in personality to the old guy. So you have Bond being Bond and Bond, and you have Felix Leiter being Felix Leiter being Felix Leiter, except for the time he loses his leg. And you have similar M's.
Yeah.
And similar money pennies.
Right. I was just going to say Moneypenny, which was conspicuously absent from the last two Bond films. But
yeah.
Go ahead, Dave.
I would say not so recently, but they did reboot Zorro, didn't they? And that's a really big gap from the early films of Zorro. And then they had Antonio Banderas come in, and I think Anthony Hopkins played his... I'm not quite sure whether Anthony Hopkins was the original Zorro and he trains Banderas up. But the point is that with Catherine Zeta-Jones, that was a fairly successful. I think they only did two. I don't know what's happened to it since. But
two of them. And the brilliant thing about that is, you know, Hopkins like you said, was playing the original Don Diego de la Vega character that was the original Zorro, and the new Zorro is as a reboot. You could start all over with new stuff, having the old premise, which was great. It was a good idea, and they did it right.
And I love fencing films. You can't actually the best fencing I've ever seen in a film. Again, I'm going on the sidetrack. Was Gene Kelly in The Three Musketeers? I mean, the fencing where he challenges them all to a duel. You know, he arrives in the town and he offends each one of them, and they each have an appointment. I will duel with you at 2. Can we make it 1? I've already got a duel at 2. And the fencing sequence in that is, you have to go right back to Basil Rathbone to see better fencing, really, way, way back.
Right.
One of the other things, and fencing's reminded me slightly of it, although it's not of it, another remake we had in the UK on TV now, although I didn't like it, was Robin Hood got a remake. They've done a couple of series of that. I didn't particularly like it. It was a bit too whizzy for me.
Yeah, part one of the final episode during tonight on BBC America, so we're right at the end of it now.
Right.
Now, I'll say this, Dave. I've noticed here lately a lot of political thrillers are starting to come to America from England that were classic hits back in the day that were 6 or 7 episodes that they're compressing down into 1 2-hour movie. Like, y'all had a show called State of Play. And I can't remember who was in it. I think it might have been Jonathan Pryce or something like that. But they turned it into a Ben Affleck movie here. But it was like a 6-episode miniseries there that turned into a 2-hour movie here. And the big one that's coming up soon is Edge of Darkness with
That is a fantastic. Well, I don't know about that, but the original Edge of Darkness with John Doe Baker in it as the American chap, and Joanna Worley as the daughter. That is as topped many, many polls in the UK as the best, political thriller espionage. Well, not espionage, that's the wrong word, but political drama. Edge of Darkness, one of my all-time favourites of that genre. Fantastic. I hope they haven't messed it up.
Well, the movie is coming out later this year, and it stars Mel Gibson. Hey, go look up the preview. It looks pretty good, but, you know, if you got something that has a long, series of episodes that tell the whole story and you compress it down to 2 hours or plus, it you lose a lot. I was telling you about State of Play. State of Play is a 6-part British drama on BBC One. It came out in 2003, and it's got a great cast. It's got David Morrissey and John Sim, Kelly MacDonald, Polly Walker, Bill Nighy, and James McAvoy. And it's, a newspaper reporter finds out about this girl who gets killed is linked to like a member of parliament, and then they're trying to kill him throughout the whole thing. And the movie has Russell Crowe and Ben Affleck in it.
Yeah, I'm sorry for your listeners who think, bloody hell, does that lad not know anything about English ones? But obviously, with yourself and Benjamin in the room, I'm sort of holding our end up here at this side. And another great remake that's due to come out is Day of the Triffids. As a TV series. It was done in the 80s with John Dutton in the lead role, and that is certainly worth watching even now. But there's going to be a remake, and I'm not even sure whether a comedian called Eddie Izzard isn't going to be in that, who's made a few little acting roles in America. I think he was in Ocean's 12, one of the Ocean's films. And there's another remake. There's another remake. Because the original one, Ocean's 11, was from the gang itself, wasn't it?
It had the Rat Pack in it.
The
much.
Rat Pack, yeah. What do we think about that?
I think the remake is great and has a wonderful cast in it, and the original's great. And it's not one of those movies that took away from the original a whole lot. Benjamin brought up something in the chat, though. There's a lot of remakes, I was saying earlier, that come from Britain to America. There's a lot of shows that don't cross over very well, and some that do. Like, and we've talked about this before, Dave, when we do sitcoms, but, Sanford and Son here is based on Steptoe and Son there, and it was successful. I think All in the Family is also a remake of a British TV show.
Right.
I can't remember what it's called. The Office, yeah, the the American version of The Office has been on even longer than the British version, but I'll say this. The British version is 5 times better. It's just, I don't like Steve Carell. He's just not, it's like he's pretending to be a snot, whereas,
Ricky Gervais.
He's like the greatest jerk on television, except for Rowan Atkinson as Blackadder.
I have to think the weirdest remake is Kitchen Nightmares, where Gordon Ramsay has essentially brought the format over, and the only real difference is how Fox wants the editing done, because the editing makes him look like a lot much more of a jerk than the British one, and you see less of what he does to fix the restaurants. But it's essentially the same show. So the American Office, that's what it would have been like in its own field.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
but,
of course, Life on Mars was another one that got its American remake, didn't it?
You know what, I have to say, that have you seen any of the American remake, Dave?
No, I haven't, I must admit. I mean, I might catch it if it comes out on DVD, but it's not promising what I've heard from other people. And apparently the ending...
I didn't think it was bad
weird.
At first. It got weird toward the end, because I guess they knew it was ending, so they started doing weird stuff with it. But, I mean, the actors in it were really good. It is nowhere near as good as the original. I mean, it's like the worst remake I've ever seen, actually, is Coupling. The American version of Coupling was just dismal. It used scripts from the British show, which a lot of the jokes were British jokes that kind of flew over the head of American audiences, and the actors that got to play the characters were just terrible. And you didn't have Stephen Moffat in charge as much as you do in Britain. Shameless plug. But the one they tried to get off the ground here was absolutely fabulous. That didn't work. They've tried to do Fawlty Towers several times, and that didn't work. And I don't know. There's just things about remakes that don't work, or if they do too much of the original, or they just get bad casting. I don't know if anybody's ever seen the pilot episode that's on the web of the American version of Red Dwarf. It's abysmal.
Mm.
Just completely horrible.
Yeah. Talking about other shows, I mean, like, in case of ones that actually like, I mentioned the Tripods earlier, of an American series, I'd like to see The Time Tunnel or something like that redone. I thought that was a great series when it came out.
Yeah, shows like that are just aching for a remake. You know, all right, speaking of Time Tunnel, you've got Lost in Space, which I didn't think the movie remake was that bad.
Not when that little creature came on. That ruined it for me.
Well, you know, they had the Jar Jar Binks syndrome there for a while. Every movie that was being remade or Star Wars had some kind of goofy character in it for the little kids. But, I mean, other than that, I thought it was, you know, the cast they got to play the characters in Lost in Space was pretty good, I thought. And, you know, they probably could have done some more, but they just wanted to leave it alone. You know, Irwin Allen is just ripe for picking when it comes to remaking a show. But I think you're right, Dave. The Time Tunnel would be a really good one, and I'm surprised no one's even thought about it. Well, they probably have, but...
Yeah. Have I heard some rumors they're going to remake? Well, of course, they remade War of the Worlds. That's another one that people like and some people don't. This Island Earth, have I heard any news about that one being remade? Because that, again, is one of my favorite. Or Forbidden Planet, was it? Something like that was going to get a remake.
I don't know. I'm looking to see right now if they have it. I know it was very popular, Mystery Science Theater 3000.
It was something like that. It was one of those really classic ones.
One project that had the distinction of having both a terrible remake and a great remake. And this one was a weird one because the bad remake had most of the original cast and was a TV show like the original. And the good remake was a theatrical movie with none of the original cast. Can you guys guess what it was?
Give us the genre. Is it a science fiction or a drama?
Well, a comedy with some science fiction or at least violence. Get Smart.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, the 60s TV show was a classic show. Don Adams, Barbara Feldon, all that. In 1995, on the Fox Network in the U.S., I don't know if this ever got to the U.K., but they got Don Adams, they got Barbara Feldon back, they got some of the characters around the edge back, and they got a new people to play the leads, including one Andy Dick, just before he became a star. And in spite of the best efforts of the old actors, the new show was terrible, mostly on the back of Andy Dick, who then went on to disparage the show in the press, hoping it would get canceled so he could stay on news radio. So he did a bad job and then badmouthed the show that was paying other people's paychecks. Then, last year, we had the movie, which had none of the old people, had actually Steve Carell, who we discussed from The Office US, and that was a great film. And that was a weird one, really, because see, you don't always need the old people.
Right. Well, one movie remake that now comes to mind, now that I think about it, that was fantastic based on an old series is The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. That was well done.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And then they had a TV series remake, The Fugitive, what's his name? The guy that was on Show Wings.
Tim Daly?
It was terrible. Yeah, Tim Daly. It was terrible. It was really terrible. I don't know. There's a lot of good. I just watched Race to Witch Mountain, and it was really good as far as a remake reboot is concerned. It's Disney, and Disney usually makes pretty decent stuff. But you know, some that I didn't like were like Mel Gibson and Maverick. I didn't think Maverick was needed. I mean, it's
Wild,
got a funny
Wild
part.
West.
No, I didn't like that.
Wild Wild West was terrible, which was a good show at one point. I know, it's a plethora of them now.
They make the comedy Bewitched, the TV, didn't they make that into a big film? How did that do? Because I don't think I caught that
actually,
one.
Actually, it's pretty good because the premise of it is they're remaking the TV show Bewitched and they get a real witch on the show. So it's kind of a remake / reimagining / TV show within a TV show kind of thing. So it made it interesting enough to, it was pretty funny actually.
And the other one they made a remake of, sorry, Wes, was Stepford Wives, wasn't it? That's another one.
Also with Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, that's what triggered my memory, I think.
I'll tell you a movie remake that I really, really loved was the remake of 12 Angry Men. The original 12 Angry Men is such a freaking classic, and then the new one was
fantastic.
Actually really good. But it
and it needs the black and white. I can't see a film like that. I don't think you can improve on. I mean, it's like, didn't they make a remake of Rear Window or something? I mean, Rear Window, the original, is so blooming good.
It was a TV movie that starred Christopher Reeve, and he's in it, and he directed it. And it's actually pretty decent, and Christopher Reeve, you know, got to act again, even though he's paralyzed. And he's about the only actor today that could play that character the same way. And it was done tonally completely different than the original, so there wasn't all the Hitchcock stuff. But yeah, you're right, Rear Window. It's just like Psycho, remaking that. Mm. I mean, how do you remake Vertigo?
I was just about to say Vertigo. Yeah, I mean, they're just so, so well-crafted that it's almost... I like cowboy films, and now some of the following ones weren't good, but the very first Magnificent Seven, I can't think of any point trying to do that. I mean, you know, Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen in that. I mean, they were just so good, and the chap who played the Mexican bandit leader.
It's like there are certain movies that you just look at Hollywood, and they haven't done them yet, and it's probably for this reason. You just don't remake. You don't remake Gone with the Wind. You can't. You can't remake.
You can't remake The Searchers. You couldn't remake The Searchers, could you?
No.
I mean, that's just come out on Blu-ray. I mean.
You know, there's a lot of Jimmy Stewart movies. They've remade It's a Wonderful Life several times. They even had one that had... what's her name? Was it Suzanne Plachette or something like that? Played the George Bailey character. They had a woman. And you just can't touch Jimmy Stewart. It's like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You couldn't remake that today and it'd be any good, I don't think.
Well, the nearest one they did to that was when they remade Miracle on, is it 34th Street or something? Where they had Richard Attenborough play.
At least twice.
Yeah,
now.
Well, that wasn't too bad, actually.
That wasn't too bad, I must admit, with the
the guy from the practice. I can't ever remember his name.
Dylan McDermott?
Yeah, Ian McDermott. Yeah, Ian McDermott. Bleh. You know, Casablanca doesn't need to be remade. Chojo de Serra Madre doesn't need to be remade. You can't do, when you got an iconic actor like Humphrey Bogart, who's the only person that could play that part, you just don't remake it.
Yeah, they remade The Big Sleep, didn't they? I think they did.
Well, film noir detective films you might could remake.
Yeah.
You know, like the Maltese
Falcon.
Well,
I don't know. Robert Mitchum in some of those early films. Did they do a remake of Double Indemnity, which was with George... what's he called? Fred Murray, was it?
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking
about. Double Indemnity and George Scott, not Scott, the little chap, the one who played Little Caesar, Edward G. Robinson, was it? Played the one who tracked him down.
Yeah, Edward G.
And Barbara Stanwyck was the femme fatale.
Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray,
yeah.
And it looked like the Billy Wilder movie.
Yeah, that was fabulous. I mean, I do hope if anybody of a younger age group, and I include you guys in that age group, who has a prejudice for watching black and white films, please overcome that prejudice. There are so many classic films. And luckily, some of these films that were set in like the 30s and 40s, in actual fact, they were made in their own present day.
Right.
But now... the very fact that they were made in their present day in black and white actually helps you as a person in the, you know, in the 21st century to go back into... I mean, if you were watching something from the 40s and it's in colour, to me that's harder. It looks like people are acting being in the 40s. But if you see them in black and white, it looks as though you're sort of going through a little time tunnel and seeing them in the 40s. So if anybody's listening to this who's got prejudice and say, no, I never watch black and white films, please put that to one side. Vertigo, actually, some of the Hitchcock ones were in colour, but if you want to go and see, you know, Double Indemnity and some of the other films we've mentioned recently, please watch them. They're marvellous films.
Yeah, I'll have to say, and there's... the one I'm trying to think of right now, a remake that was not needed from a classic movie, was The Manchurian Candidate. Because The Manchurian Candidate, to me, is like one of the most perfect movies you can get as far as the way it's shot, the way the acting was, you know. I mean, it even had Frank Sinatra in it. He's a good actor, actually. And then, Denzel's version is okay. It's all flashy, quick cuts and things like that. But, I mean, it's like they're running out of ideas in Hollywood and they want to milk stuff that was popular before. Could you imagine what people would say if someone said, hey, let's remake Citizen Kane? You just can't do it. Because, you know, you don't have Orson Welles. And I dare you to try to find a top 10 movie list that doesn't have Citizen Kane as number one, as the best film ever made. I mean, it's good. I don't know if you've ever seen Citizen Kane, but it's about a long time ago.
But the other marvelous thing that I think, again, some people of a younger generation might have prejudice against is the fact that these things were made on, a lot of them were made on 35mm film. And one of the great things about the Hollywood studio tradition is that the actual films that go out to the cinemas are like third-generation copies. So you have, like, when they make a film, especially a colour film, it's like on three separate colour masters, and then they have the negative, and then they have the first print. But if they go back, an Audrey Hepburn film that they just remastered a few years back? If they go actually back to the main individual, I think Bette Benjamin knows more about this sort of stuff than I do, but they go back to the original negative red, green and blue strips, as it were, the picture quality there is still finer than Blu-ray. In other words, you know, the Blu-ray resolution of 1920 by 1080, those can be scanned at something like what's called 4K 2K, which is 4,000 by 2,000, because of the emulsion is that good. If the film was being looked after, of course, and I'm not talking about the very early films that they had a habit of combusting, didn't they? Because they had nitrates on them or something, whatever it was.
Right.
But really good quality film. So that, I mean, I just said about 10 minutes ago, The Searchers is now on Blu-ray. Now, I haven't seen it, but apparently, you know, the picture quality is great. I've heard Louis Trapani of Gallifreyan Embassy fame mention that he's got the Blu-ray of the very first TV series of Star Trek, because that was filmed. You know, it wasn't done on videotape. And he said,
right,
they look pristine. Pristine is the word I think he used. So, you know, in some cases, they don't actually need to be made. The quality is there for a young audience if the money's put in to sort of clean the negatives up and so on.
I have noticed that black and white Blu-rays, high-definition black and white classic films, tend to look better than the newer ones. I don't know why. It may just be because it's just black and white. They don't have to remaster the color, but it's so razor-sharp it almost hurts your eyes.
Yeah.
And, like, if you've seen Bonnie and Clyde, it looks amazing on Blu-ray.
Right. Now, one film that I think is just about to come out on Blu-ray, or it might just have done it, is the fourth Terminator film. Now, I saw that in the cinema, because I don't want to see many films. The Star Trek one, I think, was the one before that. But there was so much grain artificially added. I think it was actually not done on film. I think it was done digitally. I don't think I will bother to buy the Blu-ray of that, because I've got a feeling that the resolution won't be any finer than the DVD quality because of the artificial grain that is introduced. Because it actually looks like a PlayStation 3 game. That's what the actual film looks like. It looks like a film trailer in a game.
I'll have to say that from working in a movie theater for a decade or more as a manager, you can tell when movies are shot on digital, because to me, film is really the most high-definition medium you can get. Watching it on the big screen is as clear as you're going to see. And Blu-ray is trying to copy the way film looks. The thing is, if it's shot digitally, it doesn't look like film. It looks too clear. And sometimes it's just they have to put artifacting in to make it look like film. So I think it defeats the purpose. If you shoot something, you have to downgrade it to look like one of the best-looking things out there anyway.
Yeah, one thing I did notice when I watched the Blu-ray of the Star Trek, the new movie, is I think there were only two things green I saw in the whole film. There was the green girl that he was bedding in the flat, well, trying to before he got interrupted. And the second one, I think he saw a girl in a green dress in one of the nightclub scenes. But if you actually look at all the footage on the spaceship, obviously they used some green screen thing. Everything is blue, red and grey. Almost looks as though they haven't used green in the picture. The same way as when you actually, mind you, the Matrix was slightly different to that. When they watched the Matrix, it all had a sort of a green tinge. But then
yeah,
they did that so that when he woke up in the morning and he went to work, then it was normal colour. And you thought, oh, this is the real world. And of course, I don't think it's called spoilish now if we tell everybody that the trick about the Matrix, there wasn't the one world where he was being a jockey copying data at night and working in a bank during the day. Those were two aspects of his false world anyway.
Right.
But they
used
the color clues to do that.
That was the brilliant thing about the original Matrix. I think the two sequels were kind of superfluous to the whole thing and just basically action-oriented special effects spectaculars. But the first one is a classic. And I'll have to say I agree with you completely there. A lot of people don't realize because they're just out watching the movie. And those of us who are like uber movie nerds notice things like use of color in a film or, you know, the way something is shot to accent what's going on in the storyline. You just don't notice that a lot, I guess, if you're just going to popcorn films and watching them. But there's just some beautifully shot noir things. One of the most beautifully shot movies that I've ever seen has got to be L.A. Confidential. It looks like a 1950s film noir film shot in color. And it is beautifully, the cinematographer for that was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Another one that looks really good, I don't know if anybody's ever seen it, is Ed Wood with Johnny Depp. It's shot in black and white, and it really helps the story along because it's telling the story of the 1950s as a filmmaker.
Oh, do you mean good? You don't mean Good Night and Good Luck, the one about the broadcaster, do you? Because that was also in black and white.
No,
you know the one I mean.
Movies. And no, but that is a good one. I'm talking about Ed Wood.
Oh, right, sorry.
That's okay. And then I was talking about LA Confidential, which is just that Russell Crowe. Guy Pearce movie, The Good German, which is another black and white one that came out recently, is good.
Yeah.
I like the fact that some of these directors are going back to the noir look when they do a noir film.
Yeah.
But
I mean, if you want to go back to TV, Benjamin's put in about the Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, and that was a remake, wasn't it?
Yeah. I saw the pilot in the UK and had a rather remarkable young actress, as a villain in the pilot, who I discovered years later was David Tennant. And then in all the other episodes, Tom Baker's a co-star. So it has Doctor in all the episodes as an amusing feature
cool.
to it. You had David Tennant in 1 and Tom Baker in 12.
Well, you know what? We can't talk about remakes without throwing out a remake of one of the absolute most famous, British sci-fi shows of all time was the remake of Quatermass. Because, that's a pretty big show. Did you see that, Dave?
Yes, I saw the original, yes, certainly. And I'm trying to think of another one as well, A for Andromeda, which was a sort of science fiction theatre. That was a remake. And David Tennant, I think, was in A for Andromeda. Just that was what triggered that. But yes, the Quatermass, I love the early Quatermass ones, Quatermass and the Pit. Stunning.
Yeah, the remake also had David Tennant in it, right before he started Doctor Who.
Right.
So, I mean, he's showing up everywhere. Tennant's going to take over television, I just know it. I had this dream that he's going to come to America and they're going to do a buddy cop show, kind of like CSI with him and John Barrowman as cops. That would be great.
I think his lawyer show could work if they changed the name. I don't think Rex Is Not Your Lawyer has the makings of lasting 5-7 years, but a better title, and that could be his success story.
Well, Benjamin, is the actual title going to be Rex, and then the strap line, in brackets, He's Not Your Lawyer? I think it's going to be all of that's the title.
At the moment is Rex Is Not Your Lawyer, straight up. However, titles often change, especially in the pilot stage. And they could even just turn that into the name of the pilot and then change it later. Like, Canine and Company, A Girl's Best Friend, it's very possible the name could change. I just hope it doesn't premiere under that name.
Yeah, Rex would be better on its own, I would have thought. House works, doesn't it? I mean, people think, is it about a house? No, it's about a doctor. Rex,
Rex,
no, it's about a lawyer.
If you're calling it Rex, get the girl one of the girls who played Zev on Lex in as one of the regulars, just for a bit of fun, because people think of Rex and Lex together, just a little joke.
And one thing, I might have to bow out in a minute or so, Wes, but one thing you haven't talked about is where you have a classic series and they don't remake it, but they like come back for a reunion episode. And the only one I can think of at the moment is one of these awful Dynasty or something like that. But where they'll have a series and then they'll like make a one-off movie, or Sex in the City move from the small screen to the big screen. But there are things like that where it's a sort of spin-off.
You're right about that.
In the past.
Yeah, that's a good example, because it was a TV series and they spun them off into feature films because they were just so popular. But then you got, I'll throw this out there, then we might start ending the show, but you had all the Indiana Jones movies, and then they went and did a really good series of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. Now is that a sequel? I guess it's a prequel, but But it's hour long episodes talking about Indiana Jones when he was a kid up to in his early 20s. That's a really good show. It kind of disappeared in obscurity, then they put it out on DVD in some rather expensive box sets. But it's one of those shows that I just enjoyed as a kid. But it was based on a movie series that was a huge blockbuster at the time. I'm surprised they never made a TV show out of was Jurassic Park. I'm surprised they didn't TVize that.
Right. Let me ask one last question from me, obviously not necessarily from you, is which TV series has had the most sort of comebacks, remakes? I mean, is it going to be something like Superman, or is it going to be Buck Rogers, or... Because Buck Rogers had one, didn't it? Because he came back, Buck Rogers in the 25th century, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But I assume it must be Superman that's had the most... Or Tarzan, maybe, something like that, where they've done
it
over...
It's going to be Superman, it's going to be Tarzan, or it's probably going to be something like... Well, I don't know, like Stargate has many offspring, but I guess they're all spin-off series. That's a tough one. I mean, just to say, I would have to say Superman had a couple of different shows in it. If you include the cartoons, then there's a lot
And you include Lewis and Clark and Smallville.
Yeah.
Superboy.
I guess what you're saying is how many of the same idea has been redone in different ways?
Rehashed, yeah.
Yeah. And it's probably going to fall in your superhero action genre, but I guess you could say like the premise for the A-Team is pretty much the same premise as MacGyver. It's just there's one guy who makes things out of duct tape as opposed to four guys who make things out of duct tape that don't kill people. Knight Rider, it came back, and there's a reimagining that was, to me was just awful.
Right.
And it also had a reunion film before that.
Yeah,
and it had another reimagining called
Knight
Rider
in 2000, was it?
Yeah, Knight Rider 2000.
And you're going to get some stuff like Chips is coming out in a big screen film.
Oh.
And here's the big one, the A-Team. Well, we just mentioned that. There's a big screen summer action film coming out. It's a remake of the A-Team. And it's got a pretty good cast, too. Have you all heard about it?
I know it's been in production for a decade or so.
All right, the film is starring Hannibal. Is being played by Liam Neeson. Bradley Cooper's playing Faith Man. Quentin Rampage Jackson is playing B.A. Baracus, and Charlito Copley is Howling Mad Murdock, and I don't know who those two guys are. And Jessica Biel's in it, playing the person chasing him. Oh, and then some guy named Patrick Wilson's playing Lynch. So, it could be interesting. Quentin Rampage Jackson is he's a Ultimate Fighting Championship type guy. And the guy playing Murdoch is, he was in the movie District 9, which I didn't get to see, but I heard was very good. So he's kind of a new guy. But Bradley Cooper, he's been in a lot of stuff here lately. He was in Wedding Crashers, and he was in Yes Man and The Hangover, which is his big movie this summer.
Yeah. I don't really want to open up a new field, because I said I'll have to bow out soon, but perhaps for another one of your CIAs is, different genres of films that sort of come out of fashion and come back into fashion. I mean, I love, like, westerns, but the only westerns I ever see on TV now are when they show sort of midweek westerns during the day, and I record them because, there are not many, there's no gun smoke, there's no bonanza, there's no, rawhide, all these. But yet, sometimes you can go like 5 years and the top five shows will be westerns, then
right.
The next 5 years they're all gangsters, and 5 years down the ride they're all teenage high school comedies or whatever, you know what I mean? So
right,
perhaps
I'll have to
time.
Say that going along with that thinking, sci-fi is back in a big way now, because like a lot of the top TV shows right now are sci-fi, like Fringe. And I would have to say that most of the CSI shows are pretty much science fiction because of the technology they're using to solve crimes in 5 minutes. But
Fringe is good. And then you had, you know, V is out now and everybody likes that. Flash Forward, which is getting really good. And Lost, you know, stuff like that. People are starting to really get into sci-fi again, but they've made it mainstream enough where non-sci-fi fans can enjoy it too, because it's just a very good, engaging story. And I guess on that note, we've been running about an hour and a half now, so I would like to thank my compatriots on the show today, like Dave. Good to be on the show with you again. And Benjamin, always a pleasure. Diane, I want to thank you for being here. And anyone else who might have actually listened to us today on this semi-reboot of CIA, I would like to thank everyone. And if you would, Dave, do you want to plug your show on there?
Well, that's great. But two things before that. First of all, I might not always make this Saturday because it's not that a great time for me. But just to in your honour, I am drinking a bottle of Penfolds Rawson Retreat Cabernet, Shiraz Cabernet, in your honour. So there you
are. Thank you very much.
And yes, tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we will be talking about who pulls the strings. We're talking about things like Thunderbirds, Stingray, Terrorhawks, all the films where they're not actors, but they're actually puppets and the shows that we remember from that time. We may also diverge onto other puppet shows that don't have strings, but that's our starting point. So that's Torture ID 54821, The Cultdom Collective, and you can check us out at cultdom.com. Thanks for that.
Yeah, these guys do a really excellent job, like they always did on this show. So, yeah, I picked today because I didn't want to interfere with all the... Because Sunday is starting to get kind of loaded down with stuff, especially when Podshock does a show. So it's kind of... I'm going to try a couple of different times and find one where people can come on if they want to and not interfere with things. So we'll get it figured out. But I'd like to... I appreciate everybody who's supported CIA in the past and will hopefully continue to support CIA in the future. And I'm hoping all these people still have their feeds turned on and they forgot to turn them off. So
yeah, and don't forget, there are 100. This is not episode one, although it might be the reboot. There are 100 past episodes for them to download as well.
Right. This is episode 101. And the beauty of CIA is that there's a always changing gaggle of hosts on here. So, you know, you got different voices and different opinions to listen to. And I appreciate everyone's support over time. And just to let everybody know, we're back. And I'm not going anywhere in the foreseeable future. So thank you guys for being on here today. And we will see you next week where I'll have hopefully another interesting topic when I can think of one. Talk to you guys later. Everybody have a good day.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Ben. Cheers.